Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Bhadavataranayanye Bhuvo nava ivo dadao Siddhantya puribharena Jato hyatma bhuvartitaha Bhadavataranayanye Bhuvo nava ivo dadao Siddhantya bhuribharena Jato hyatma bhuvartitaha Bada avataranaya. Just to reduce the burden to the world. Anye others buvaha of the world. Navaha boat. Iva like. Udadhao on the sea. Siddhantya aggrieved. Buri extremely. Bharena by the burden. Jataha you were born. He certainly. Atma bhuva by Brahma, Artitaha, being prayed for. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. Others say that the world, being overburdened like a boat at sea, is much aggrieved, and that Brahma, who is your son, prayed for you, and so you have appeared to diminish the trouble. Purport. Brahma, or the first living being born just after the creation, is the direct son of Narayana. Narayana, as Garbho Dakshayi Vishnu, first of all entered the material universe. Without spiritual contact, matter cannot create. This principle was followed from the very beginning of the creation. The Supreme Spirit entered the universe, and the first living being, Brahma, was born on a lotus flower, grown out of the transcendental abdomen of Vishnu. Vishnu is therefore known as Padmanabha. Brahma is known as Atmabhu, because he was begotten directly from the Father without any contact of Mother Lakshmi Ji. Lakshmi Ji was present near Narayan, engaged in the service of the Lord, and still without contact with Lakshmi Ji, Narayana begot Brahma. This is the omnipotency of the Lord. One who foolishly considers Narayan like other living beings should take a lesson from this. Narayana is not an ordinary living being. He is the personality of Godhead himself. And he has all the potencies of all the senses in all parts of his transcendental body. An ordinary living being begets a child by sexual intercourse. And he has no other means to beget a child other than the one designed for him. But Narayana, being omnipotent, is not bound to any condition of energy. He is complete and independent to do anything and everything by his various potencies, very easily and perfectly. Brahma is therefore directly the son of the Father and was not put into the womb of a mother. Therefore, he is known as Atma Bhu. This Brahma is in charge of further creations in the universe, secondarily reflected by the potency of the Omnipotent. Within the halo of the universe, there is a transcendental planet known as Shweta Dvipa, which is the abode of the Kshirodakshayi Vishnu, the Paramatma feature of the Supreme Lord. Whenever there is trouble in the universe that cannot be solved by the administrative demigods, they approach Brahmaji for a solution. And if it is not to be solved even by Brahmaji, then Brahmaji consults and prays to the Kshirodakshayi Vishnu for an incarnation and solution to the problems. Such a problem arose when Kamsa and others were ruling over the earth, and the earth became too much overburdened by the misdeeds of the asuras. Brahmaji, along with other demigods, prayed at the shore of the Kshirodaka ocean, and they were advised of the descent of Krishna as the son of Vasudeva and Devaki. So some people say that the Lord appeared because of the prayers of Brahmaji. Some people say. Here, Kunti Devi is mentioning various opinions about why Krishna came down to the earth at this time. It's a question. What business does God have to do here in this world? What business does he have to do to get involved with all the politics, all the conflicts among conditioned souls? Generally, God doesn't get involved in our material conflicts. They are to be worked out under the direction of the material energy, and following our desires and our understanding, we go ahead and resolve our conflicts by fighting or by making peace. God has nothing to do with any of that. So what? Because of the evolution of time, as the Dwapara Yuga gets near its end, the motive passion becomes too prominent. In the first age, Satya Yuga, the mode of goodness is prominent, but as it shifts into the second age, mode of passion begins to become prominent. But by the end of the Dwapara Yuga, the third age, mode of passion has reached its peak. And when it moves into the Kali Yuga, then the mode of passion, ignorance begins to take over. So the peak of passion, passionate influence, prominence, is found at the end of the Dwapara Yuga. And therefore, there's big conflict at the time of the transition between Dwapara and Kali. Battle of Kurukshetra is a great conflict. Hundreds of millions of soldiers died. Human society was severely disrupted. The conflicts we see in our own time are actually only a fractional part of what was experienced at the beginning of the Kali Yuga. And in order to take advantage of the situation, the imbalance of nature, many demons decided, because demons are always looking for an opportunity to take control in the universe. They are there as the perpetual opponents of the rulers of the universe, the demigods headed by Indra. Indrari vyakulam lokam vidayanti yuge yuge. Is it Indrari vyakulam lokam? The incarnations who are expanding from the original Supreme Lord Krishna, Swayam Bhagavan, Krishna's tu Bhagavan Swayam. Indrari vyakulam lokam. So the world is often throughout the universal history, it often happens that the demons are threatening the control of the demigods. They are the perpetual opponents, antagonists. They're always there. Sometimes the demons gain temporary supremacy, and sometimes they're forced down to stay in the crevices of the Bila Swargas or the Patala Lokas below the earth, and they're kept in there and not allowed out. Sometimes they get out. They're never completely, they never get permanent control, neither are they ever completely annihilated. They're always around, but they're sometimes suppressed, the demons. But they had a good opportunity at the end of the Dwarpa Yuga because of the excess of the motive passion. Motive passion is required for any life. A person who has no passion, no rajas, cannot live. Rajas is the energy that creates transformation. Transformation is usually done by radiant heat energy in your body. We are mammals, animals like other mammals, that we're not plants. We don't just hold our hands up in the sky and live by photosynthesis. We have to digest, eat food and digest it, even if we're vegetarians. We have to put food in our mouth and process it through the digestive system. That digestion requires the fire of digestion. It's not, you know, an ordinary fire in our stomach. It's hydrochloric acid and other enzymes, the peptic fluids coming from the stomach, the bile coming from the liver, the gall coming from the gallbladder. These are manifestations of fire. And fire, this fire of digestion, aham vaishvanaro bhutva, praninam deham ashrita, Krishna identifies himself with this fire. Because that fire is practically the essence of active life. Unless you're a vegetable, you need this fire to live. So Krishna says, this fire is me, this vaishvanara. What's the derivation of vaishvanara? The name of the fire in the stomach. Where does it come from? Can you tell me the suffix? What root does it come from? No, Vishwa. The pronoun Vishwa, it's one of the 21 pronouns, isn't it? Vishwang? It's one of the pronouns, Vishwan. Means everywhere. And Vaishvanara, Vishwanara, Vaishvanara. The fire that's in every man, every living being, or every higher animal that has a process of digestion. He has the fire of digestion that is centered in his abdomen, although it's also functioning in the liver, in the spleen, and in the gallbladder. There you find the fire that makes digestion, which is, that fire is required to break complex molecules. If you eat ice cream, you like the ice cream, but your system has a difficult time digesting such a complex of sugars and carbohydrates and whatever else is in the ice cream, nuts that are also hard to digest, chocolate syrup, whatever you have on your ice cream, that all has to be taken care of by the digestive system. So these enzymes have a lot of work to do. This is process of the mode of passion. Fire is the manifestation of Rajoguna. Rajoguna rules all forms of transformation, change. So we need rajas to live. You can't enjoy your ice cream and digest it without Rajoguna in your stomach. The problem is when there's too much. In your own body, too much acid means you get a sour stomach. You suffer indigestion. You ate too much ice cream, and now you got a stomach ache. That is over predominance of the mode of passion in the form of the hydrochloric acid in your stomach. Well, the earth also suffered indigestion at the end of Dwarpa Yuga. Too much rajas, shown in the form of unruly kings, burdening the earth. The earth herself can carry heavy loads. That's her. She's built for that, to hold everything up. All the cities on the earth with all their skyscrapers and all the things that human beings create and pile on top of the earth. And then they generate population by sex, and billions of human beings are on the earth and quadrillions of other creatures inhabiting the earth. The earth can hold all of that. What is the one burden that the earth cannot tolerate? A liar, yeah, a dishonest person. And also these demons are a burden because they are liars by nature. They're dishonest people. So the burden of it's a burden to the earth because it's deceptive, cruel, dishonest people. These demoniac kings. So where do all the demoniac kings come from? I mean, there are only so many demoniac people available in the general populace of the earth. Real powerful demons are rare to be found. You can find people who are cruel, who are envious, who would like to do harm to others. But usually they can't do very much. Because nowadays anybody can buy a gun and shoot a few people in the street and become a prominent demon in that way. But that's small time. Where do you find real demons? You have to import them from the Patala Loka. And that's what happened. At the end of Dwarpa Yuga, many demons from down under managed to take birth on the earth. You can read it. It's all described very explicitly in the Adiparva of the Mahabharata, how various demons took birth. And then, in order to counteract that, demigods had to take birth also. So the whole battle was lined up beforehand. It's a proxy war, the Battle of Kurukshetra, between the demigods and the demons fought on the earth in the disguise of various kings, the good kings and the bad kings. But actually, most of them are coming from the other planets, the planets of the demigods and the planets of the demons. Most of these great warriors who are on the battlefield. The Pandavas themselves were literally sons of various demigods by Kunti and Madri. And many of the other warriors on the battlefield were actually incarnations of demons and demigods. So it's a proxy war, just like the wars that are fought nowadays, that were fought previously during the Cold War between the United States and Russia. The United States and Russia never fought against one another officially. They never had a declared war. But there was the Cold War, and the patrons of the United States would fight against the patrons of Russia in proxy wars. So this Battle of Kurukshetra was like that. A war between the demons and the demigods, but in the disguise of a family quarrel in the Kuru dynasty. That's the burden of the earth that's being talked about here. Quite an unusual situation, distressful situation for Mother Bhumi. And we know the story in the beginning of the 10th canto, how she went to Brahma, accompanied by other demigods. She may not think herself important enough, so she asked the other demigods to come with her to talk to Brahma and try to get relief. And he went to the shore of the Kshirodaka ocean and approached Lord Kshirdakshayi Vishnu by sitting down and meditating, sent him an email message, and got a response by the same means in his heart. Instructions from Lord Vishnu what to do and how he's going to relieve the burden of the earth. We know the story. That's what's being alluded to here. This is being cited as one of the reasons, one of the possible reasons, one of the alternative explanations of why Krishna came down. Some people say this, some people say there's some other reason. Actually, all these reasons are true. Krishna came down for all the reasons that are described in these verses. It's not really opposing opinions that can't all be true. They're all true. Krishna, whenever he acts, whether it's in the spiritual world or the material world, he's basically the same person in both places. It's just that we have a different insight If we go to the spiritual world, we'll see Krishna's full manifestation of all his pastimes, unlimited by any restrictions of time and space. So Krishna can be doing everything at once and having relationships with all his devotees all at once in the spiritual world. And if we go there and have the spiritual vision to see, that's what we will observe. If we see Krishna in his lila in the material world, or we read about it in the Shastra, like the Bhagavatam, we'll see a different picture, but it's really the same Krishna doing basically the same things. It's just our vision is different. Because when Krishna enters the material world, he voluntarily enters the restrictions of time and space. And therefore, he only does one thing at a time. He's only in one place at a time. Devotees have to wait their turn to associate with him. Those are his prakrita, or public manifest pastimes. But really, the pastimes, unmanifest or unmanifest, are all the same. It's just we have a different vision. We can only see within space and time. Therefore, Krishna conforms to it so that we can see his pastimes in the material world. In those pastimes, you may have different reasons, different arguments to explain why Krishna has appeared. What is he doing? But in all his activities, whether we're seeing them from the spiritual point of view or from the material point of view, he's always accomplishing many things by every one thing he does. He accomplishes multiple purposes by every one of his acts. So the very act of his birth, which is only the first thing he does, taking birth is just the beginning of Krishna's lila. After that, things get even more interesting. He does so many amazing things, so many attractive things. His birth is only the first. It's a very prominent activity. We could spend the rest of eternity just meditating on and glorifying his birth, but he has many other things he does after that. But we can, here we're seeing multiple purposes being proposed for why he took birth. They're all correct. This one is correct, and the others. He took birth for Vasudeva and Devaki to save them from Kamsa. He took birth to deliver the earth on the request of Brahma. He took birth to relieve the distress of the living entities by giving them something to hear and chant about and remember. All of these reasons are true. And we may have some purpose also. We may have something we need from Krishna. Krishna fulfills that, whatever it might be, whatever our individual needs and wants are. They're also all fulfilled by Krishna's simply appearing and is performing his other activities. Therefore, Krishna tells us, janma karma cha me divyam evam yoviti tatvataha chatva, what is it? Deham punar janma naiti mamiti sorajuna. If we simply understand, even theoretically understand, what to speak of have realization of, what to speak of actually entering in those pastimes, if we even just have theoretical, philosophical understanding of the special quality of Krishna's birth and his activities, then we don't have to take birth again. Understand Krishna's birth? You don't have to have another birth. Understand his activities? You can join in on those activities. Of course, birth is just another one of his activities, but it's special. It's the first activity. Krishna's taking birth is very special thing to remember and glorify. Okay, so any questions or comments? Hare Krishna. Dermot Abram.
So what is the actual reason that Brahma is going to ask the Lord for the solution? He's not powerful enough, Brahma himself, or he just wants to know what's the Lord's, what is it?
Yeah, I think the situation is out of hand that even Brahma cannot solve it by himself. If Brahma could, then there would be no need for Lord Narayan to have an incarnation. It's when, first of all, Brahma doesn't get involved in the quarrels. He's there for advice, but he doesn't fight. Brahma doesn't get on his swan carrier and join the fight. that's not proper for him. You know, it's out of character. It's not his responsibility. He's the father of both the demigods and the demons, so he doesn't get involved in their fights. You know, he doesn't take sides. So he's not, for that reason, he's not going to take on the role of killing the demons. They're his own sons. So for that one, that's one reason why he has to go elsewhere to get the solution. And also, the situation is so severe that even we have to conclude that even Brahma could, even if he were not acting out of character or against his duty by getting involved, it's more than he can handle. And therefore, they have to go to Vishnu in this case. So many cases, when Vishnu is resorted to, it's because Brahma and all the demigods can't solve it themselves. If they could, then they wouldn't go to Vishnu. They wouldn't bother him. You know, if the head manager isn't needed, then the lower managers can take care of something. Only when everyone else can't take care of it, then you go to the head man. Okay. Yamatan Mohan then Damodar.
Brahma is a pure devotee, and for a pure devotee, there is nothing more severe than and intolerable than separation from Krishna. But at the end of Srimad Bhagavatam, in the 11th canto, we see Brahma and other demigods, actually Brahma speaking on behalf of demigods, telling Krishna, okay, Krishna, thank you very much, you came, and you sorted out our problems and plights. Now we do not need you anymore. Please go back. And whenever we need you, we'll call you back. But we'll manage now. From now on, we'll manage ourselves. So how can that be put together with Brahma's position of a pure devotee?
Because as a pure devotee, he should help facilitate Krishna's pastimes. Krishna's pastime is that he comes to the earth for some time and then goes back. So Krishna is returning or leaving this world. It's part of the pastime, and Brahma has to do his job of helping to facilitate that. Even though it means having to ask Krishna to leave. But it's required. It's required to complete the pastime the way Krishna wants it. So as a faithful devotee, he does the thankless task of asking Krishna to leave this world.
But we never see any other pure devotees facilitate Krishna's pastimes in that way, like Pandavas and Kunti Devi. They always pray, please Krishna stay, and even if it takes more plights to keep you here, we are ready to do that. And
everyone else can ask him to stay, but Brahma's got to ask him to leave. Yeah.
Krishna, you're out now.
Yeah. Brahma has priority. He's the chief demigod, so Krishna listens to him. Even though everyone else is asking him, don't leave.
Can that instance be taken as an indication that Brahma's position, even though he is a pure devotee and one of Mahajans, but actually he is not as great as other devotees for whom they don't really care what they have to do to Krishna, but they want to keep him?
If you want to, I mean, I don't know if I would blame him for that. It's your judgment. You want to blame him for that. You know, mark that as a discredit that he asked Krishna to leave. But I just think he was doing his duty. A thankless task, but that was his role in the pastime. At least he didn't have to act as a demon and fight with Krishna. He had his battle of wits with Krishna in the Brahma Vimohana Lila. But he didn't have to get embarrassed like Indra was of actually becoming inimical to Krishna. He never had to do that. Other demigods did. So Brahma, compared to the other demigods, he's less fault. You can't ascribe as much fault to him. If you want to blame him for that, okay, but I don't know if I would. Okay? I'm sorry, Damodar.
I hope this is proper to ask. I'm just saying, so what's the reference for the modes of passion in the different yugas? And also the second question, where is it explained that Krishna comes within the time
Let's explain it. Okay. First, I think, is if not in the Bhagavatam, I'm sure it's somewhere in the Bhagavatam. First chapters of the Vishnu Purana describe the workings of the modes of nature in the times of creation. I have to look to find exact reference, but it's there. How in different ages the different modes are prominent. It's common information. It's there in the Puranas. I pinpointed, I have to look.
A lot in the Puranas.
And about the distinction between Krishna's manifest and unmanifest pastimes, that's explained by Srila Jiva Goswami in, I think, Bhakti Sandarbha. Or maybe Krishna Sandarbha. I'd have to look for the exact spot. But that information we get from Jiva Goswami. The definition of what are Krishna's public pastimes and his private pastimes or invisible pastimes. It's also discussed by Sanatana Goswami in his commentary on the Brihad Bhagavatamrita. But Jiva Goswami made a systematic formalization of it. Okay. Yeah. Yes.
Brahma requesting Krishna to go, and about that I had to say, this time I had a nice experience because Govinda Kundrava mercifully asked me to take Narsingadev with me to worship Narsingadev. But then I had very nice experience worshiping the deity, and finally when I was leaving from home and taking Narsingadev away from home, my mother and father, they were very attached to him.
Lord Narsingadev.
Yeah,
and you didn't leave him there, did you?
Yeah.
You left him at home?
No. When I was leaving from there,
yeah.
And then when I was taking Narsingadev away from there, my mother almost started crying, and she was cooking for him very nicely every day, even though there were so many problems. They may feel that it's unjust that we take Narsingadev away, but Brahma, he in his mind, what he has in his mind is Krishna came. There may be many other reasons, but in his mind, isn't it that he has that Krishna came here because he called him here?
Yes.
So, and Krishna is always available for him, yes. Even in Ramaloka as Mahapurusha, and also
yes.
In Kshirodha Krishna Vishnu. Yes. And so, okay, now I keep him there, and now I take him away. It's like his deity. He's like his
because Brahma is the proprietor of the universe. So he's the host. And he's saying, the guest, you know, you had your reservation booked. It's, you know, don't you remember, you know, today's the day you're supposed to leave. The host is not kicking the guest out, but reminding him, you have plans. You intended to go somewhere else. Just reminds him, that's all. Brahma's the host. It's his universe. Not kicking him out. He's just reminding Krishna, you have some plans to go somewhere else, don't you? About Lord Narsingadev, if anybody's going to Puri, you can go visit the workshop of Jagannath Mahapatra and you can probably get another copy of the same deity. It's made out of jade. I paid 400 rupees for him. And we can get one and send it to your parents. Okay. yes. Do you want to go?
I was wondering, did the demigods have darshan of Lord Shrodagashai Vishnu?
Not at that time.
If not, why?
That's just his mood. He doesn't want to be bothered with all the politics. So it's not that he... You know, sometimes they see him. Sometimes he appears in person on the battlefield. Sometimes Vishnu participates in the battle between the demigods and the devotees. We see that described in Puranas. Even in the Bhagavatam, Krishna himself was present on the battlefield. And Kshiradakshaya Vishnu, maybe sometimes he goes out and joins the fight. But most of the time, he doesn't get involved. Real reason is probably that the demigods are not as pure devotees. They don't get to have his darshan, to be with him all the time, or much of the time at all. Very rare. The demigods actually see Lord Vishnu in person because they're not Krishna conscious enough to deserve it. Okay? Yeah. They deserve the protection, but they don't deserve the darshan in general. Okay? Yes, sir.
Sometimes Lord Brahma, Lord Shiva, they go to Goloka instead of going to Kshetrakesha Vishnu.
Do they go to Goloka? Do you know any instance of that?
Like Garga Samhita.
In Brahma Samhita, Brahma had... I don't know if he physically went or it was just a vision.
Garga Samhita.
In Garga Samhita too. Okay, so Brahma, we have a couple of instances where Brahma went to Goloka, yes. Because he worships Govinda. He chants, at least the current Brahma, currently worships Gopal in the Gopal Gayatri Mantra. So he, because of that, he gets sometimes the darshan of Krishna directly. Yeah, sometimes. Shiva, I don't know. Maybe. Maybe he also gets. But occasionally, Brahma lives a long time. And once in a while, he may get the darshan of Krishna directly. Yeah, anything else? Bhartran Brahma?
In the third canto, in one place, it is said that Krishna appears and disappears like this. Dehanyasa asya, like that the verse begins. Dehanyasa asya, something like that the word verse
meaning?
Begins. That the taking of appearance, disappearance of Krishna, it is dhiranam dhairya vardhanam. It increases the dhairya of those who are dhira. But for those who are materialistic, those who are not dhiras, for them it's just a mental disturbance. That's how it's, yes. That's how it means. Could you explain how it's a mental disturbance for? I mean, I have some idea of it, but I want to have a more clear idea
how Krishna appears and disappears.
Is a mental disturbance for those who are materialists.
Well, that means that they cannot fathom it. They cannot understand it. Krishna promised that if you understand how I appear and disappear, then you get liberation. So those who don't deserve liberation shouldn't be allowed to understand it. If they do, they're going to get liberation. They can cash in that knowledge and get liberation. So those who are not fit for liberation can't be allowed to know, understand how Krishna and why he appears. The mechanics of his appearance, or the transcendental mechanics of his appearance, cannot be understood by materialists, because that will give them liberation. They don't deserve it. So Yogamaya will arrange for them not to understand. They can hear, but they still won't understand. Only those who are pure in heart are going to be allowed to understand the simple fact of how and why Krishna appears in this world. Only sincere devotees, who are the only real people who actually deserve liberation. They're the only ones who should be allowed to understand it. Otherwise, it's putting power in the hands of people who don't deserve it, and that will be dangerous. That knowledge is power. It's the power of liberation.
Well, then wouldn't it be enough for them to be just kept in ignorance? Like, they don't know about it, but why it should be a mental disturbance?
Well, many people are kept in ignorance. They never heard these stories. Other people hear the stories, but they don't understand them. Both ways are effective ways of Maya keeping them in ignorance. Those who never hear, and those who hear but misunderstand, Maya keeps them both under control.
But they get mentally disturbed when they hear this.
Yeah, they hear and they don't understand, and just it's a headache for them. And demons like Hiranyaksha and Kamsa, they hear about it, it just gets them angry to hear about Krishna's exploits. But even people who aren't demoniac, but they're just materialistic, it's just confusing to hear about. It's bewildering and a headache to hear about Krishna's pastimes. Therefore, they don't want to hear about it. Don't tell me about these things. It gives me a headache. Only devotees, sincere devotees, can appreciate and understand and have any taste for hearing. Materialists don't want to hear. It just causes them disturbance to hear it. Okay, so we'll stop here. Thank you. All glories to Srila Prabhupada, Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai.